Yes, I was saying it would be like the first night in coming to the thing, you had a game, and President Clinton, and the world leaders, and so on and so forth came to him and bowed down to him, and stoned him, and asked him for advice, and so on and so forth. So, you would say that what Yaakov was saying was that a person, a normal person, wouldn't have to dream, even though anything is possible in dreams. But the dreams you have would be like thoughts that are connected to your reality, somehow or other connected to your reality. So therefore, a person will have a dream that, his boss or whatever, and it's something to do with his work, his boss, and so on. So something, in other words, even though the dreams are feminine, but even the distortion takes place in a certain context of your reality. You see? So if you put yourself into that reality, it means that you must have been entertaining these thoughts and giving them reality. You see? In other words, that's what he's rebuking them for. You wouldn't have had such a dream unless you were in your daytime life, you're really thinking such thoughts and really endowing them with reality. That's why he rebukes them. Because you're allowed such thoughts, and a person's responsible for that. And the person has control. When a person, entertains certain fantasies, he entertains them. I mean, he's intelligent, he rejects them, it's ridiculous, and then he stops thinking about it. When a person entertains a fantasy of being a great thinker, or a great general, and a great politician, and then he goes off into the, and he really believes these things. And then he finds himself being rejected by people. No one listens to him. It's his fault. You should know your place. You know who you are, know your place, and don't entertain the story. That's what Yaakov was saying to him. The question is like this. What was Yaakov's two attitudes like to him? In other words, Yaakov, by you guys, though, Yaakov rebuked Yosef for the dream. Okay? And he said, Mo'achalam Adashacham Amta. Okay, now Rashi gives his interpretation. According to Rashi, the interpretation, there's a machlokas between Rashi and Ramban, actually, as to what the review consisted of. According to Rashi, the review consisted of the fact that it's a false thing. Because the Shemesh refers to the father, the son, and the Yerech refers to the mother, right? And the mother is dead. And just like it can't be, that's what Rashi says. And just like it's false. It's false with regard to that, so therefore the whole thing is false. Okay. And that Rashi is Avon Avon. The Rabbi Allah Rimcha is Far Mesa. The mother is dead. Now Rashi, who are you? Yodaya says, Van Magin Baduha. Should be dealt with, That's so, what Rashi is saying is like this, that the dream, here Rashi is saying the dream is really true. Yaakov thought that the Yaakov understood the symbolism. He's the Shemesh, and of course you see the whole context. And the 11 stars, the 11 men. So therefore, the moon has to be the mother, and the mother's dead, so it's false. Because the dream can't be false. And the ruler can't be false. Right. Now, Raja says, but the dream, in fact, was true, but the Yerech here refers to Bila, who played the role of the mother. Okay? But apparently, Yaakov held that the dream would be exact with regard to the specific. You know what I mean? She's a better than the hours, she wasn't. But I was saying along the time, saying halam below the varam b'tel. And the rabbis learned from there that there is no dream, even a prophetic dream, which does not have the varam b'tel, which doesn't have an emotional element, psychological element. Okay? Which means to say, if you take a look at the specific chachamim, that they disagree. In other words, Shane Sovim, Shapirish Incha, Eino, no fail, Ella al Eino Mamet. In other words, you see, that's one question. Does the interpretation of when you interpret the dream and a certain component refers to the mother, does it have to be the actual mother, or can it be anyone who plays the role of the mother? I don't know. I mean, that's the question to how Nevuah is interpreted. We're not going to explain that. Obviously, we're not going to go into that. That doesn't matter. Okay, but you see, what Chazal was saying is like this: is that even if you maintain that Imecha has to be taken literally, and that therefore there's something false in the dream, that does not disqualify it from being a prophetic dream. Okay, so there's a lot of different opinions over here. Obviously, I mean, we're not dealing with something which is an exact science, so we know, you know, we don't have the exact detail. But nevertheless, Chazal held that there's no dream, even a prophetic dream, there's no dvaram b'torah. Okay? But whatever the case may be, we're really concerned, the question that concerns us is a few things over here. I mean, one can ask, that's a legitimate question, how did Yaakov regard the situation? Did Yaakov regard the dream as being prophetic or non-prophetic? If he regarded it as being prophetic, so then perhaps the course, a better course might have been to simply tell the brothers that this is the word of God. Why wouldn't he have done that? Now, we know that the emotional state of the brothers is antithetical to Yosef, but we do assume that they were great men, and that if they were forced to surrender to the Almighty, so to speak, that they would do so. That question was raised by, I think, Sam. Let's say Yaakov would have had, the question could be asked a different way. Let's say Yaakov would have had Nebuah. The same thing. And that is to say that this is the future. The future will be that Yosef, from all the sons, Yosef will be the leader. Now, that idea doesn't seem that there was, Yaakov would have been fine to Yaakov. Yaakov would have rejoiced. I mean, it seems that Yaakov already had earmarked as the number one son. You saw a lot of Yosef Nicol Bonham, right? The Yosef looks on his posthumy. He seemed to, if anything, not formally, but he sort of showed his favoritism. He was the superior one. He gave over all the chachma, a shame of to Yosef. Okay. But the dream just, what would he have done? What would Yaakov have done? Yaakov had a problem on his hands. See, that's something that always bothered me, in that the matter got out of hand. And how do we understand such a thing? For many reasons, because how could the brothers who were really tzaddikim, shifteka, the great people, you have to say that. The leaders of Klal Yisrael, how can they do an action which is something which is inexplicable even among the lowest of the low? You know, you don't find in the family, this is certain powerful family feeling, and there's rivalries, there's hatred, etc. And if it ever comes to murder, it's got to be over something. You know, it depends on the person, but all we see here is very little. I mean, an act of favoritism. Right? So they didn't like it. See, a little snitching. Fine. But you don't find that they got into trouble. And then some dreams. And as a result of that, you know, let's kill them. The causes that the Torah is presenting to us obviously are intended for us to be able to understand the subsequent results, but they don't seem to fit. Now, there's no question in my mind that everything has to do with the dreams. The dreams are very decisive. So we have to see what's happening with the dreams. We also have to see and analyze the behavior of Yaakov. And I said that Yaakov does suffer the most as a result of all this. He's the unintended victim. And to what extent did he fail to, were his failures responsible? How did he handle the situation, or mishandle the situation? Because he does have an opportunity. He plays a very crucial role due to the fact that Yosef did tell him the second dream, and due to the fact that we find that it's Yaakov himself who put Yosef into the lion's jaw. He sends him out on that fatal mission. And Yosef accepts it. These things are very important. Why, given the hostility that existed, why would Yaakov endanger his son? You see, later on, the extent to which he clung to the Yemen, wouldn't let the Yemen go, because there was a perceived danger. Okay, these are some of the general questions. But getting down, what I'm concerned with now is that second dream, because now Yaakov enters into the picture, and Yosef decides to tell the dream, the second dream. Yosef decides to tell the second dream to his brothers and to his father. So the first question is, after meeting the chilly reception from the first dream, you would have thought that he would have learned his lesson. They were not thrilled to hear it, and they by Yosifu Otsno Oso. It increased the hatred. Now what was Yosef's point? To increase hatred? That was his whole mission in life. Yachudav L'shalom occurred even before the dream. So that you can even ask, well, why did he tell him the first dream? Okay. Having told him, what's going on over here? I mean, what is the great need for Yosef to tell the dream? That's a major question. What is that great need of his? Why not keep it a secret? I mean, you believe in it? Obviously, Yosef believed in the dream. He believed that it wasn't just a dream, because nobody goes around telling you dreams unless you believe they're very important. All right? In other words, Yosef did not interpret his own dreams as being an expression of delusions and grandeur. Because if he did, he'd start working on his emotions. So this, what was Yaakov's point? Everybody agrees, all of them are from the dream. But Yaakov's purpose in the Ge'ara was to try and deal with the problem, to uproot the hatred from the brothers. That's clear as hell. Dad, you know, according to Rashi, the method of doing so was to discredit the dream. According to the Ramban, the method of doing so was to discredit Yosef and to rebuke him and to go much further. They're saying, this is craziness. First of all, it's craziness. I mean, in other words, the way the Ramban learns it, Mach Alam Adesh Rech Alamta, is a very good rebuke, because first of all, it includes the fact that this is craziness, that the dream is crazy. But okay, that's one thing. But then he's really attacking Yosef for having the audacity and the chutzpah to dream such dreams. Who are you to dream such dreams? So it's putting him in his place. Okay? But according to the way Rashi learns, he's not really attacking Yosef, he's just dismissing the dream. It's nonsense. You follow? Which is the more effective way? Because Ramban is trying to explain the word. You see how important it is to try and understand the word of Torah? Machalom azeh asher chalamta. What is this thing you mean? What does that mean? What is this thing you mean? I just told you what it means. What's the sense? So I'm buying this two interpretations. His first interpretation is, he gives other examples in the Torah. But he means to say that it's nothing. It's ma. What is it? It's nothing. Eno klum shetazidehu. This is meaningless. What are you telling us? It's nonsense. This is burn the town. It's nonsense. Okay? Oh, Tama Da'ara Loma, if Nisach Alibcha, Lachalom, Lachalom Azeh. So, in the first interpretation, the Ramban is more or less like Rashi, except he's not, in other words, Rashi's saying that he displayed the dream because of the verb tem, that's nonsense. And it comes out, yeah, of course, that's a medrash, by the way. Plain shot is like Ramban, you see. That's a medrash, that Kishen, that just like it can't. Just like it can't be true with regard to your mother, it can't be the whole thing is false. Okay, but they both agree, though. In the first instance, they both agree that the approach of Yaakov was to denigrate the dream itself. This is nonsense. So Ramban then gives another shot and says that he criticized Yosef. This is Eich Masach Alipcha, and there's something wrong with you. Where do you get these what kind of crazy thoughts you have? You even have dreams like this. Okay? The basic questions that we have are, first of all, the strange behavior of Yosef. What is the motivation of Yosef in telling these dreams? Which is even the doing so, he's an intelligent, obviously extremely intelligent person. And we would even ask the question with regard to the first thing. Well, I guess tell us those the dreams. Okay. But certainly, after the reaction that the first dream elicited, certainly, you would think that he learned his lesson. Well, what purpose did he have in telling him the second dream, the insistence? And here he tells it twice, once to the brothers alone, and then to them in front of the father. Okay. Now, the second question is with regard to the behavior of Yaakov. Of course, you could ask the question, how did Yaakov regard the dreams? Did he regard them as being true, in the sense of Nebuah, or not? Now, if he regarded them as being true and that they were Nebuah, so then why would he take the course? Might not the better course have been, even though the brothers had hostility and animosity, but it seems to me convincing that if they were convinced that this is the will of God, if they are the direct Jesus from Hashem, to accept this, then they would have no choice. Maybe that would have been the better course. Okay. So we're not quite sure exactly what Yaakov's attitude was. Now, the rebuke that he gives to Yosef does not necessarily reflect his attitude, because all the Mepharshim say that he did that for a reason. He wanted to put out the fire. Okay? He wanted to resolve the conflict. That was his real objective over here. The next question would be, what happened? Why was he not successful? It doesn't seem that it succeeded. What was the strategy of Yaakov for dealing with the problem, and why did it fail? Okay? And finally, I think we have to connect this to the next episode, and that is, it seems that Yaakov himself is the catalyst for what happened, because he sent Yosef to go and check on how the brothers were doing in Shechem with the tongue. And why would he put him, why would Yaakov put him into a situation of danger? Of course, you can also ask, with regard to Yosef, a similar question. I mean, a Yosef had a chiyuv of kibud av, but I think that's one of the mitzvot kibud av mi'ein, where it's yav aval yehareg. I mean, if your life is in danger, your parents, you know, I'll command you to go out at night and get some food from the local restaurant, and you know, yeah, you're afraid of a robbery, whatever, you don't have to go. Fuck it. So you have to tell them. There's another question, which is extremely important. Because, take a look at Pasuk Yudalef and tell me what the problem is. Yudalef is extremely strange. Yudalef is extremely strange. For what reason? Because, first of all, it's a different reaction. The reaction to the first dream was the dream of one of hatred. They hated him. But the reaction to the second dream is one of jealousy. So first of all, what are they jealous of? What were they jealous of? Why is this produce jealousy? If anything, we would assume that it would produce greater hatred. Why jealousy? But beyond that, there's another question. What did the brothers think of the dream? Either they thought that the dream was true, or that it was false. Now, it seems pretty clear that they didn't regard these dreams as being true, right? They said, "Benir, my yechalamosa." We'll see what happens before we come to the dream. So clearly, they maintain that this wasn't the will of God, right? This is nonsense. If that is the case, and then Yaakov seems to agree with it, because Yaakov disparages the dream. So now they have it from the authority Yaakov that these dreams are nonsense. So what are they doing? So what's the jealousy? It becomes very, very difficult. What are you jealous of? Of what? Then it says, the other shomer hagadol. And his father guarded the matter. That's, again, the Torah is speaking in a vague kind of a way. It doesn't tell you exactly. You see, the Torah describes things not in an exact kind of a way, in an imprecise kind of a way. Because what does that mean, he guarded the matter? That requires, you can't even read it. You don't even know what it's talking about. Well, guarded what matter? It requires something. Is not written like a human type of a work. A novelist writing the same way, you know, assuming the role of narrator, who knows everything, knows the thoughts of all the characters, would be much more specific. So you'd have an idea, you have a much more clear idea from reading it, what exactly it means, what his thoughts were. On the simplest level, it means that don't go by what Yaakov said over here. That's on the simplest level. And he said once, on the simplest level, what Yaakov said, Mahachalam Azeh. In other words, the Torah is warning you not to take, Yaakov's true attitude is not reflected in his words, because his words were intended for a specific purpose, so his thoughts about this were different. Shamar HaSadala. Well, what exactly he thought about it, we don't know. We still don't know. We don't know. Pasuk Yudalef is telling you the result, the reaction to what occurred. What occurred was, event, Yosef tells over the dream for the second time now, but this time for the first time to Yaakov. Yaakov responds, okay? Yudalef tells you the result. The brothers had this reaction, and Yaakov shown up again. The Sponer has a nice interpretation. There's room for different interpretations over here. But the Sponer has an interesting interpretation, by Ikanu, Bo Echo. In other words, his interpretation is that they were jealous of him, merely, not because they believed the dream was true, but merely because of the fact that he had the so-called audacity to tell over to the dream. The father said, just that itself aroused their envy of the relationship that he had with the father. That's a beautiful interpretation. In other words, because this is, look how it answers all the questions. Because our question is, why should they be envious? A, they didn't believe the dream was true, right? And B, the father, they should be thrilled. They got the perfect reaction from the father, from the Rebbe. The Rebbe said this is nonsense. So they should have walked away rejoicing. But the fact that in their minds, they would never just say Elvis to thing in front of their father, right? And that Yosef was unafraid and was eager to tell this over to his father, indicated the closeness. Sometimes you have that type of a thing. You have that type of thing when you have certain things that you'd be ashamed to say in front of the Rebbe. You'd be afraid to say it, or your father, whoever you're facing it. And then somebody else comes along and says these things, that opens up the fact that they are so close and he's so confident about the relationship that he can say whatever he wants. He has a totally different relationship than you have. He wish you had that relationship. So that is envy. That's envy. In other words, this, according to the Sfoyo, more than anything else, brought out to them the full extent of what it means to have such a relationship with Yaakov Avinu. And that made them very angry. The first dream was sinner, because the first dream was strictly, you see, the first dream was something which was strictly between the brothers and Yosef. So the brothers, the relationship was one of hatred. And when they heard this dream, it increased the hatred. But the second dream brought Yaakov into the picture. And by bringing Yaakov into the picture, Yosef unwittingly revealed something about the special character of the closest of the relationship. That is the worst thing you could do. That's the day going back to the original cause. The original cause was that favorite thing. That's what envy is, a sibling, that's envy of the highest degree. I think that most people can relate to this, because there's certain times you'll see that, once you have a relationship with the Rebbe, okay? And with that relationship, you only restrict yourself. You're only discussing it. You ask a question, halacha, this and that. And you're happy if it's a good question about you have to spend time with you and explain it to you. You feel good. But you wouldn't bring up other issues. You feel a certain distance. You don't feel free to just walk over to the Rebbe and talk about, all kinds of issues. Then you see another guy comes over and starts discussing other things and that. And, he's free to do so, and he doesn't have this inhibition. And then you're envious, you realize that this person has a totally different relationship than you. He's like almost a friend, he's been biased, he just walks. You have to call up for an appointment to come to the house. Huh? Yeah, then you see another guy, you called up, you waited 2 weeks for the appointment, you come in, you have 15 minutes, you have everything worked out, what you can ask. Then another guy just calls up, comes in off the street, and he knocks on the door, and just stopping by, I'm sorry, and you call up, the Rebbe says, come on in, don't worry, I'll be... The point that I'm trying to make, I think I did that, it's something that you can relate to. Something you can relate to. Because at that moment, when that occurs, you realize that this person has something that you don't have, and you would want the most. Okay? That's what you would want the most. What you want is that type of relationship that you can walk in any time. You don't have that. You know that you have a formalized relationship. But you can call upon the fact that you're a student or, you need help, etc. That's one type of a thing. That's one type of a level. But where you don't have to go to that, where the Rebbe loves the guy, he's happy to see him. You come at any time and whatever excuse he makes up is accepted. That's a certain status, and that is the stuff of envy. In families, I mean, everybody can pick up on this. That's what people pick up on. People go, no, those types of things. It's not so much what you say, but what they call, body language. It's like people know they can pick up on that. The different reaction. When you walk into a house, when you walk into a room, you get one kind of reception. Then another person comes in and he gets even a slightly different reception. A certain smile lights up on the person's face. And you compare, you notice that even when you came in, you got a different kind of smile. You got a smile, but a different kind of smile. You see? And ever so slightly, and you think that the person himself is not even aware of this thing. What do you mean? When you came in, I agreed with you, and he came in, I agreed with him. I didn't get any differently. Sure, you did not. But your emotions were different, and those emotions show. In that sense, what you said before is correct. The only thing is, I don't think that applies to, that's not what the father said. That doesn't apply to Yaakov over here. The Yaakov was not in that situation. It was the Yaakov's behavior in the situation that did it. What he's saying is, though, that the fact that Yosef felt totally free to tell such things to his father. And they could not do so was only because this was a confirmation. This was a confirmation of the fact that Yosef had a very special relationship, and something that I guess that you always deny. This type of thing you always deny. Until you see it face to face, you can't deny it anymore. You see, when you see, when you have an opportunity to see an expression of that closeness. That's the spoiler of interpretation. I mean, it's an ingenious interpretation. So we have to give it to Krishna Yaka, right?
Why
is he talking about? I'm sorry? What was Yaakov's true attitude? Did he really believe they were nevuah, that they were true or not? And if he did, why did he tell the brothers that it was nevuah? And also, his handling of the situation. It seems that he was not successful. His objective was to uproot the hatred and didn't do it. So did he do something wrong, in other words? Is there a better way he could have handled it? I think we should analyze that. It's fair to be fair. Okay? But sometimes it's not a person's fault, you know. It doesn't, just because we failed doesn't mean you choose the best strategy. The results aren't in your control, especially when you're dealing with other people's emotions. So that's one possibility, or else it's possible to say that he didn't handle it properly. Here's where I chase that shot over here. That what was the difference between the first game and the second game? The first game produced a reaction of hatred. The second one produced a reaction of anger. So it says later on, when the brothers came down to Mitzrayim, you know, to get food, and Yosef didn't recognize Yosef, so it says, Vayistar Sachaloma. And remember the dreams, and then he accused them of being spies. So the question was, what does remembering the dreams have to do with the accusation that they were spies? Okay? So the answer that Rabbi Sheikh gave was that, because what he did, in fact, was to put them through an accusation and to cause them tremendous pain and suffering and so on and so forth, all of that was done to bring them back to Tshuva, Mashem Shemayim. But Rabbi Sheikh said that a person doesn't have a right to do that. Because you don't have any right to inflict pain upon another individual in order to do it against the good. Yeah, because it's got a personal thing with Khan and Pina. You don't have a right to interfere in somebody else's life, even for his benefit. You know, you see a person's running around with the wrong crowd, so you take away his car and this and that, and lock him up, put him in the country, whatever, and then it really does become better as a result. But you just don't have a right to do it. You don't have a right to inflict pain on another person. Well, I'm talking in the standard case. I'm not talking about a father raising a child. Father raising a child has certain special rights. A red man, Tom, special rights. But the normal case. Normal case. I mean, Yosef and his brothers, Yosef didn't have any particular rights to put them in jail. For what? He did it all to put them in excruciatingly painful situations for the sake of bringing them back to children. So what mantra did he have? So the answer is that it was the dream. And the dreams were nevuah. But how does the dreams relate to that specifically? He said that there were two separate dreams. The first dream, which represents the bundle, that represents economic power. And he would have economic power over that. Okay? The second dream is the Achat Arsa Kochavim. It refers to the brothers at Kochavim. Now Kochavim means spiritual greatness. And he's the sun and the moon, that's Yaakov and the mother and the entire family. I mean, in other words, the entire family is basically, the real essence was their intellectual greatness. That's what they really lived for. And that the dream was saying, the first dream was simply saying, he has physical power over them, economic power. Amalok Timloch, Marshal Timshol, that's rule, that's physical power. So that, they didn't envy. They just said that wasn't a value of theirs. But they hated him because they looked at it as being an expression of his own emotions. That any person that would want such a thing would be a base individual. He's looking for power. Any person who wants power is a low individual. But the second dream referred to the phenomenon of the Chachmah. That showed that he would be the leader in terms of the Chachmah, in terms of the ideas, the philosophical system. And it all bowed down to him. So, in terms of being the spiritual leader, when Yosef remembered the dreams, so what clicked now was that the two are interconnected, and that Yosef knew what each one meant, but until that point he didn't realize that one would be the means of the other. In other words, that the attainment of physical and economic power over the brothers would be the means by which he would assert his spiritual rule or leadership over them. And give him the right, therefore, to do what was necessary to bring about their perfection. So that's fit for Yisroel and Chalomos. Now he was in a situation where he had economic power. They were coming down. That was being Ma'al Ma'alim. Come out with the Gami, so their bundles were bound to his bundles. It means that they were at his mercy because of economic need. And that gave him the right, that the dreams were saying that he was to use that for the sake of Kochan. That in terms of the spiritual, they should, have to acquiesce to his rule. He would be the leader in terms of the spiritual, and that even over the father. That gave him the right to devise the plan, which had the purpose of bringing them to perfection. Now, in the course of that explanation, so he said that that's why the second dream was Kina. Because the first dream was simply depicting Yosef as having economic power that they didn't envy, because that wasn't their value. But what they really valued was the intellectual. And this showed Yosef as being the ruler in terms of the intellectual. So there the reaction was envy. That's the way I should explain it. And to the best of my memory at this point. The only question we could ask is, what do you mean? But that wouldn't... But did they believe it or didn't they believe it? Okay. In the first dream, they hated him because they didn't believe it was true, so therefore it indicates his emotions, and that's, so we hate a person like that. A person whose emotional desire is a power is a low level individual. Now, I think what was left unexplained, I don't know that, the explanation is that there's still a little bit of a problem because he's saying they envied him because they. But this depicted him as having the spiritual leadership, as being the Talmud Chacham, the Gadol, the Gadol Adar. That makes perfect sense, because that's something that they would envy. Yeah, the only thing is, but did they believe it? If they didn't believe it, so why should it produce envy? Mm-hmm. And you have to deal with that question. And you have to deal with that question somehow or other. Yeah, in other words, it's not such a big question. You think it's like this, it's not so clear. Human emotion is very strange. I mean, a person cannot believe and still feel envy. That means on a certain level, it bothers them. It's just, in other words, if this was meaningless, let me put you this way. If they didn't have genuine respect for Yosef, then I don't think they would have hated him. I don't think they would have envied him. I mean, Freud said about, anti-Semitism, the idea of the chosen people, something to the effect that ever since the Jews proclaimed that they were the chosen people, and the rest of the world has acted as though unconsciously they really believe it. In other words, the point that he meant was that if a certain group of people today, an obscure kind of people that have no accomplishments to their name, I don't think, and they would proclaim that they're the most superior, most advanced people in the world. I don't think it would bother anybody. It'd be amusing. Amusing, whatever. We'd ignore that. I mean, you have to, there's nuts in New York, on Times Square, this and that. You always have people that proclaim themselves that they're the Messiah, There's a guy walking around, he claimed that he was God. all kinds of things, from quotes in the Torah, and you were like cardboard on, And so he was proclaiming that he was God. Nobody bothered him. Nobody felt threatened by him. It was an amusing kind of thing.
Nobody was jealous.
So if the Jews were small little people, insignificant, and the claim that we were chosen by God. We were chosen by God, and God gave us a law. It was a violent parasite of our. So why should anybody bother us? Why should it cause such tremendous hatred? You mean? I mean, basically, you don't agree with us, but you think we're crazy. So we're crazy people. So leave us alone. You follow? Cannot be. Everybody's disturbed by it. Everybody's disturbed by it. If they're disturbed by it, it means that they believe it. On a certain level of mind, it's something which they believe, but they can't accept. They can't acknowledge. And what she loves the Mashiach, well, nobody else acknowledges. That's all. That's the whole thing with loves the Mashiach. When the world will finally acknowledge consciously that which they've been acknowledging unconsciously and denying consciously throughout all history. That's the most important. That's all. Well, that's what Chazal says. There's ain't being olam hazel la olam haba, meaning the most of Mashiach, el shibud malchus levan. That's it. And then they'll all come running. The whole world will come running. How's it going to happen? Where's it going to come from? In other words, it must be something which was planted in their souls from the very beginning of time, as I was saying. But due to the crookedness, they can't come up. It can't work its way through to the conscious mind in the proper way. And when finally all the emotional issues will be resolved and removed, and then that thought that they're all one will come to the fore, and then they'll come running. You know, it's not going to be like Yeshmiyahu. Like I'm told now, they think we're not, and then God will show them the light. No, the light is there. They can see it from day one. But all the distortions and all the haters, all the enemies are preventing people from seeing it. So and they'll be removed because they won't have a basis anymore. And so you can see the process here. You can see the foundations of Christianity are being undermined. You know, it's the new research and so forth. And, I don't think it has... You can't predict anything. Nobody can. Who can predict? But there's a tremendous movement within Christianity itself to destroy Christianity. As people study the history, they come to the reality, they'll see it. It's the whole thing is full. Check it. But Christianity itself is a testimony based upon the assumption that the Jews are judged. You can't get it. And Islam is based on that assumption. They know all the distortions. You see, because that assumption. They acknowledge something and they deny it. They can't tolerate another consequence. Okay, so we're talking about Christianity can only survive if it can demonstrate, if it establishes its legitimacy by its connection to Torah. There's no other way. It has to be able to demonstrate this logical conclusion, whatever, continuation, and through Jesus. Historical research from Christians themselves beyond any shadow of doubt is showing you that for no basis. I mean, Jesus had nothing to do with Christianity. Period. No connection whatsoever. When they lose Jesus, they're dead. Dead in the water. Because then it's just something of a paganist system they created. And there's no connection with the so-called Old Testament. They can't live without an Old Testament because no one assumes that at that point in time, whatever year it was in history that God revealed himself to the world and said Christianity is no one knew. They have no basis except through the Old Testament and the distortion thereof. But the key figure is through Jesus. When Jesus is finished, they're the Christians, not Christians. There's no way to study the history. It's very hard to deny fact. You know, it's possible, but it's doable. They will, because they're totally oblivious, but... my sense is that it's starting to fall. But again, I don't know. I can't predict historical, you know, those types of things very much. All right, getting back to the situation over here, the reaction of Tina is very appropriate. And I think in this situation, it's not a matter of choosing this interpretation over this foreign interpretation. I think all these things, you're talking about a very powerful emotion. A very powerful emotion. And clearly, in my opinion, the brothers did not regard it as being prophecy on a conscious level. But in the same vein too, the first dream, why would they hate him if they saw his face? If somebody tells you a dream, and this dream indicates he has tremendous desire of megalomania, so you think he's crazy, but you're not going to necessarily hate him, because you don't think he's to be a threat. I think everything is founded upon the fact that at a certain level of the mind they did consider him a candidate. And the fact that Yaakov favored him, that too, they were envious and they disliked him. Yeah, but again, that had to bother them. Why, it couldn't be that Yaakov was totally crazy. If Yaakov did favor him and did give him the coat and did convey to him all of the chachma, that means that there must be something there, and it bothers them. So they repress it. Now the same thing would apply over here, that now the nature of this person, of his dreams, his plans, and so forth, take into consideration not just the physical, but the spiritual. There, the reaction is one of envy, on any level of envy, the fact that he told it over to Yaakov. The fact that it brings to mind his tremendous spiritual, you know, capability, his tremendous chachma, his tremendous knowledge. And that's something that they envy. So, you see, it's not that, it doesn't mean necessarily that they believe it, it's true, but it brings to mind, it created the phenomenon of envy within them. And it arouses the envy. It arouses the feeling of envy. It arouses the feeling of envy because, I'm saying, at a certain level, they recognize they were afraid, in other words. They recognized that they didn't want to acknowledge it. The spiritual superiority. That's something to be envious of. I mean, I'm just giving a very trivial kind of example. It would be like someone, like somebody wouldn't admit that they're envious. You see, in other words, I don't think they would admit that they were envious. The Torah is describing the state of affairs here. I don't think they would admit that we envy him. It's not that type of thing. You see? It's not where Rashi says that Rachel was Makana of good deeds, the good deeds of Leah, that she was dealt with that children. That's an envy that she'd admit. Yeah, envious. I don't think by Makana were they were envious of him? I don't think so. Because envy, this kind of envy is something you deny. It's like we have, like with this competition, who's the smartest in the class? And there's one guy who's always getting the, approval of the rest. And the other guy is envious and they dislike him. So they're always going to deny that he's the, they'll say he's not really smart than else, he just knows how to manipulate. But they're really envious. But if you tell them that, they'll say, well, you don't envy him. I would say it's on that level, you see? And it means what this dream evoked was a different emotion, an emotion of envy, because this had to do with the other component of their attitude towards Yosef. And you see, it was based upon that factor as well. Yosef had tremendous superiority in the realm of custom. And that was bothering them. And to the extent that was a factor in Yaakov's relationship to Yosef, it was a relationship of custom which they didn't have that produced envy. And that came out in the second thing. And the second dream evoked that whole idea. That is to say that Yosef would be the superior son in terms of Chachmah, to the extent that even Yaakov did acknowledge him, the gigantic one. That aroused envy. Doesn't mean that Yaakov accepted the rule is true, but the very fact that aroused envy. There was enough there to cause them to bother him. And if that type of thing bothered them, then it would be envy. Because you see the greatness of the brother from this. Because in the first instance, where it's a matter of physical power, so that's not envy. Okay? That would be hatred. Because that's not something they wrote. So person that is just intent upon gaining physical power, that's something we dislike. We look down on a person like that. We're not envious of a person like that. But somebody who is in pursuit of the spiritual preeminence, and the person who's in pursuit of it, I'm saying, wouldn't bother a person unless she discredits it. There's something to be concerned about. You see? Then I think the Spoil's answer fits in nicely too, that it helps us, because the fact of the matter is, the dream does include Yaakov. Where did he get that from? Where did he ever get the idea that Yaakov would die down to him? You see? Because he had a special relationship with Yaakov, and Yaakov did regard him as being the most intelligent one, the most learned one, so forth. Let me say one more thing. I'm just speculating. I don't know. I think about it tomorrow, but I'm wondering if one can say that the rebuke of Yaakov really wasn't good enough. And perhaps, you see, if you take Rashi pretty literally, so what's right? In other words, he's saying like this. What is this thing he's doing? He's not saying that the whole idea is totally crazy. He's just saying there's one particular over here. He's showing him from the dream this dream can't be true. Okay? Maybe that's not so good. Meaning to say that the concept is not totally nuts. It's just that I could show you from the dream. In other words, just like it's not true with regard to your mother, so too, the whole thing is not true. Yeah, but that's not enough. That's not the answer that I would want. That means to say that this particular dream is not a dream at all. Yeah, but just if you come back with another dream, which is better, if the dream was slightly different, then it would have been good. You see, that is not necessarily the best rebuke. Maybe you shouldn't have gone into the dream. That's not the best rebuke, because by taking the dream seriously and trying to break it down from the dream itself, that's not good. That already means you're dealing with the dream seriously. You're taking the dream seriously, and you're going to show him from the dream why it can't be the voice. That's not good. Somebody came here, somebody had to say the dreams, that he's going to... He definitely is convinced that he is Mashiach. Right? And he's getting into a fight with the other Talmidim, you know? Now, the other guy said, you're completely crazy, it's insane. You know, like, Mashiach, you know, the Rambam describes Mashiach as this level of eminence, and so on and so forth, and he has that rule, and so on. And then he gets out of here, and then they decide to, we'll go through right now. We'll take the case confused. And, you can imagine, we all come together, and the guy takes his plan. And I say, okay, let me look at, you know, and I start to take it very seriously, and I show you specifics and so forth. I think everybody else would be astounded, like I'm taking it seriously. And at a certain point, let's say I can't answer one of your questions. So it looks like at that point in time, like, you're right, what's that? And in other words, the fact that I am taking the claim seriously, but I'm rejecting it because of certain particulars, that shows the average idea is being a Bahari. So that's going to keep alive the animosity. I should say, I should not even ask for any specifics. What are you, crazy? The very fact you have such thought shows that you're crazy. You see? That, I mean, the Ramban seems to be taking that approach. I know. I mean, according to Rashi, but I'm wondering that he does say, why did Rashi say that? You see, Rashi apparently is learning that Yimchavatita says it's crazy. So, I mean, for the moment, I'm just working along the confines of that. And clearly, according to Rashi, he just says it's crazy. So he tried to show him from the dream. Now, that alone, maybe is not sufficient. Maybe the rebuke that shows you that the rebuke wasn't strong enough. In other words, it's possible that at this point in time, he might have been able to uproot the nature of that reaction had he taken the situation more seriously. Now, it's pretty clear from what happened that Yaakov. The reason why, perhaps, why Yaakov did not succeed in uprooting the hatred is thus seen from subsequent what happens that Yaakov was not sufficiently attuned to the state of mind. That's part of Yaakov's mistake. In other words, I can't imagine that Yaakov would send Yosef out knowing the true feelings. So it means that that's part of the faith, that he's not only distorted the situation in terms of his favoritism of one son, but he also misread the attitude, the hatred, the animosity. He tried to deal with it, but he didn't deal with it successfully, and the proof is that even after that he sends him forth. Not realizing it. Now, I think that the reason for that is, you see, when a person has a certain distortion of reality, feels very, very strongly about something, you see, so then he also distorts. See, think about it. When a person, let me say it a little bit differently. When a person feels very strongly about something, there's no doubt in his mind that this is the best candidate or the best person. He always assumes that everybody else feels the same way. You can't take seriously, and how can you not think of that? See, even if other people don't agree overtly, but he will underestimate the extent. He'll always underestimate the extent of the disagreement, because things are so fuzzy, so clear. Everybody just you see? In other words, he sort of has a problem with the brothers, you see? The brothers did not have the same estimate of Yosef as he had, but he underestimated it. Because when a person makes a decision, his view of Yosef was such, he had such tremendous respect for Yosef, that even though he realized the brothers didn't have the same idea, but he underestimated the extent of the hatred. You see, that's another part of the distortion. You always will distort how other people look at it. You see, because you can't imagine. You can't imagine that other people will not agree with you, or that if they disagree with you, the disagreement will be so tremendous when it's so clear, it's so precious. You see? So in my opinion, that is part of the error of the judgment of Yaakov, that he made a mistake by showing favoritism to Yosef. He did not gauge the state of mind of the brothers properly. For had he done so, he would have acted differently to uproot the anger. And I think the proof of this is that he was unaware of the extent of the anger, because he sent Yosef into a situation of danger. Now, had he known, had the brothers truly felt about him, he wouldn't have done it. He can't say that. There's no basis to say that. It's clear. I mean, he wasn't compelled to do so. And he wouldn't have put him into danger. You see the amount of suffering later on. So it's not, at this point in time, he does not understand the extent of the hatred that exists between the children, which he is the primary force in bringing about. You see, so that is part of the, that's what I would understand in this situation.